Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'll be reading True West Magazine. This is the May-June edition, 2024, and it looks like this first article is from a classic True West archived article. Tom Mix's Last Sundown by Walt Coburn. This idol of millions spent his last evening on earth with old friends, old memories, but new hopes, and no Hollywood premiere was ever more dazzling than the Arizona sky, which was his final backdrop. I was sure riding the old gravy train, writing Western stories for the pulp paper magazines, getting high rates per word and averaging 2,000 and 3,000 words a day, keeping my blunt nose to the grindstone 6 days a week, getting up at sunrise, and working 4 or 5 hours before calling it a day, and never missing a deadline. A far cry from punching cows for $40 a month and beans. I was living high on the hog, spending money like a cowboy in town, always bearing in mind the trite old saying that there's no pockets in a shroud. I may have had a mild case of what the cowboys call Stetson fever, buying drinks for the house and enjoying life to the hilt. As the feller says, spending my money on houses and lots, the houses being saloons and lots of booze. It was my thrifty wife who saved enough money to buy a tract of land in the Catalina Foothills Estates in Tucson, Arizona. 16 acres on a hill that commanded a view from all compass points of 5 mountain ranges, the Santa Catalinas, the Rincons, the Tucson Mountains, the Santa Ritas, and the Tortillas, and on a clear day you could see plumb into Old Mexico. We contracted for the building of a Spanish-type house constructed of burnt adobe, and by the time it was completed by builder John W. Murphy and architect Joseph Jostler, it was really a showplace. The glassed and screened front porch was 66 feet long, with the master bedroom on the east end and a guest room on the west. The living room, game room, and den were in between, with servants' quarters and laundry and storeroom in the rear. We furnished the entire house with black walnut furniture, handmade and hand-carved by master craftsman E. Garrett Anderson of California. Each piece of furniture was made separately, and it took almost 5 years to complete the furnishings. The switch plates throughout the house were made of hand-hammered Arizona copper. The doors were all hand-carved by a Mexican wood carver and decorated with antique iron hinges and locks. The floors were of polished tile from Mexico, the drapes hand-woven and hand-painted by local artists. The patio in the rear was flagstone with a large sunken fire pit and a 3-foot burnt adobe wall around it. Giant saguaros and other cacti and native shrubbery covered the 16 acres, and below, and out of sight from the main house, was my one-roomed adobe workshop with a large picture window that offered a view of the Santa Catalina Mountains to the north. There was a corner fireplace, flagstone floor, and a small porch facing south, and the door was divided stable type, so that during warm weather, the top part of the door could be opened to let the sun in. There were no electric lights, no bothersome telephone, thus affording the privacy I needed. Plumb out of sight and beyond earshot of any visitors who might drive up of a morning, anyone who tried to reach me by telephone could leave a message for me to call back when I came up to the house for lunch. The day's work done, and the stable door of my shack closed. The word studio I never used in connection with my workshop. I called it my shack, and that went as she laid. All that gives the reader a sort of background for the story that follows. That warm, sunny day in October 1940, when I closed the stable-type door of my shack and came up to the house about noon, was destined to remain branded in my memory for all time. My wife had gone to town and had left a message on the telephone pad in the den. The message was from Sheriff Ed Eccles, saying that he was bringing Tom Mix out that afternoon for a drink. As a rule, when I'd finished work and had lunch, I headed for Bill Coleman's barn where I kept the buckskin cowpony Tex that Bill had given me. I would saddle up and ride until supper time. Once I rode into the foothills, I could relax and forget the story I carried inside my boneheaded skull. Tex was strictly a one-man horse, and always those yellow eyes were watching for something to spook at, with his short black ears cocked forward to listen. When a flock of quail winged off with a whirring sound a few feet ahead, Tex would whirl and jump sideways and charge off through the mesquite and catclaw brush. You sure as hell had to keep awake when you forked old Tex. It had gotten to be a game we played, me and Tex, and both of us enjoyed every minute of it. Tex had a keen eye. If he saw a bunch of stray cattle grazing, he'd head for them, expecting me to rope a calf just for the hell of it. But with company due to show up, I would have to miss that afternoon ride. I took a shower and shaved and got dressed in my town garbadine riding pants and a new pair of alligator boots, and then went to the kitchen to grab a ham sandwich. I had just finished eating when the front doorbell rang, and when I got out on the screen porch, there stood Sheriff Ed Eccles and Tom Mix, and the sheriff's car was parked on the gravel driveway in front of the long hitch rack. The bell was originally an altar bell from some old mission in Mexico, and it was attached to a coiled spring with a rawhide rope for a pull. Tom kept giving the rope a little yank and listening to the deep tone of the bell and its soft echo. He'd cock his head sideways, his white Stetson at a jackdeuce angle, a sort of half-smile on his lips as he kept ringing the bell. Years of erosion had almost obliterated the date of 1780 on the rough bronze casting. "If you ever take a notion to sell that old bell," Tom said as I opened the door and let him in, "I'd like to have it. Where the hell did you ever get it?" "My wife brought it back from Sonora, Mexico," I explained. When all Catholic churches and missions in Mexico were closed and the priests and nuns were run out, some of the faithful Mexicans took all the santos and priests' robes, all bells and bronze baptismal fonts, and buried them in the ground. My wife gave it to me as an anniversary present, so it isn't for sale, Tom, for sentimental reasons, or I'd give it to you. "When a man's been married half a dozen times," Tom Mix smiled sardonically, "any sentiment about wedding anniversaries is cold as the ashes of last year's campfire. Paying 'em all them alimonies sort of drowns out the romance." I led the way into the bar, and the three of us had a drink. Again, Tom Mix's attention was fixed on a genuine old oxbow complete with wooden hoops that once fitted over the necks of oxen. I explained that it was a present from Tex Wheeler, the sculptor and artist. Wheeler was born and raised on his father's ranch in Florida, and he and our neighbor, Reuben Jelks, who bred racing quarter horses, had gone to Florida for a visit and had brought the oxbow back tied to the front bumper of their car. I'd had the electrician convert a couple of old railroad lanterns to electric lights, and now they hung from the oxbow over the pool table in the game room. Tom was also interested in the small disappearing bar behind doors, which were covered with cowhide and studded with hand-hammered Arizona copper nails. He insisted on a guided tour of the whole house and my shack, which took about an hour. Back on the porch, we made ourselves comfortable, with our drinks resting on the broad arms of rawhide-laced and cushioned chairs. We rolled our own cigarettes, not with Bull Durham, but from a caddy of English Three Castles tobacco I ordered from the London Pipe Shop in Los Angeles. With cigarettes lit and warmed by good whiskey, Tom Mix and Sheriff Ed Eccles began swapping yarns. Ed had the cowpuncher brand of dry humor that had won fame and big-moneyed glory for the one and only Will Rogers, an old-time friend of the three of us. Ed Eccles had operated a cow outfit in Arizona before he became sheriff of Pima County. Both Mix and Ed had worked as cowhands, and Mix had won the bulldogging at the Seattle Washington Rodeo in 1909, and Ed had won the steer roping at the Calgary Stampede in 1912. Ed and Tom got to telling about traveling with the Zach Miller 101 Wild West Show and about all the cowhands who rode broncs and roped steers and bulldogged, men such as Bill Pickett, Neil Hart, and Henry Grammer. "I worked on the spring roundup," Tom Mix said, "up in your part of the Montana cow country, Walt. Punched cows for 40 a month for the Circle Diamond when Johnny Servant was the wagon boss, long about 1904-1905. Me and Henry Grammer hired out to work for the outfit." Tom sloshed some whiskey into his tall glass to cover the ice cubes. "You recollect the time Grammer shot that sheep shearer in a saloon ruckus in Malta?" he asked me. I said that I was at the Circle C ranch at the time and had heard the story from Jake Myers, the Circle C wagon boss who had been born and raised in Oklahoma, where Grammer came from. Jake claimed Henry Grammer was a good cowhand and one of the best ropers in any man's cow country, that Grammer was on the wild side and tough as a boot. Jake said that the spring roundup was just over with and the Circle Diamond outfit had just pulled in at the home ranch. Henry Grammer had gone to Malta and had killed some sheep shearer who had been bothering some old sheep herder. The sheep shearer, tough in his own right, had pulled a knife and made a pass or two at Grammer. Grammer was unarmed, having left his six-shooter on his bed at the ranch on Milk River. The sheep shearer's knife had slashed the front of Grammer's shirt across, and he cussed out the Oklahoma cowpuncher, telling him that he was going to spill his guts out. Henry Grammer then jumped over the bar and grabbed the bartender's gun and killed the sheep shearer. Grammer, still armed with the bartender's six-shooter, was buying drinks for the house when the constable at Malta came in to arrest him. Grammer told the deputy that nobody but Sheriff Puck Powell was going to put him under arrest. At that time, Puck Powell was sheriff of Valley County and stationed at Glasgow, the county seat. Grammer told the constable to get in touch with Powell and tell him that he, Henry Grammer, would be at the Circle Diamond Ranch on Milk River, a few miles from Malta, where he would give himself up without any trouble. And that's what happened. Johnny Servant, the Circle Diamond wagon boss, foreman, and ramrod for the Bloom Cattle Company, who owned the Circle Diamond outfit, hired the best criminal attorney in Montana and laid cash on the line for bail bond money. At the trial, Henry Grammer's plea was self-defense, and he was sentenced to 3 years in the state penitentiary at Deer Lodge. He served out his sentence with time off for good behavior. So I was familiar with the story of that shooting scrape of Grammer's, although I was a kid at the time. I remembered there had been many different versions of the killing. One was that instead of a knife, the sheep shearer packed a heavy railroad spike sharpened to razor's edge on a grindstone, that the husky, tough sheep shearer had cut and slashed the unarmed Oklahoma cowpuncher until he hollered quits. "I'm going out to get my gun," Grammer was said to have told the sheep shearer. "I'll be back directly, and you'd better have a gun in your hand, because I aim to shoot the guts out of you." As the three of us sat on the porch, I told them of the different versions I had heard. Tom Mix said he wasn't there when Henry Grammer killed the sheep shearer who had abused an old sheep herder, and Grammer had played out the old man's hand with a six-shooter. Mix said that when Grammer had served his time in the pen, he had headed south to Oklahoma to join his roping partner, Clay McGonigal, and that at one time or another, both of these men had held steer roping records as well as team tying records at all the big rodeos. I was content to just sit back and listen while Tom and Ed talked about rodeos with humorous anecdotes about different bronc riders, ropers, and bulldoggers who had hired out to the Wild West show. Then they went on to talk about the big rodeos and the Calgary Stampede from the time of the first cowboy contest claimed by Prescott, Arizona in 1888 up to the present era. One of Tom Mix's daughters had married Harry Knight from Calgary, Alberta, one of the top bronc riders of all time. Harry Knight was then living at Florence, Arizona, where he was in the cattle ranching business with Twain and Bill Clemens, descendants of Mark Twain. Despite the fact that the champion bronc rider and Mix's daughter had agreed to split the blankets, Tom Mix and Harry Knight were close friends, and Tom said that he was going to stop at Florence to see Harry on his way to California. Tom had presented me with a small paper-bound book he had written about himself. It was titled Ropin' a Million, and there was a head-and-shoulders sketch of Mix on the cover, with his long rope outlined around the sketch and fastened to a sack marked $1 million. The story had been reprinted from Photoplay magazine. I still have in my possession the book he autographed on that October day in 1940. Tom said he had it made to make a million, and he'd got the job done and had a hell of a good time spending a lot of the money. In the book, Tom said he had made over 370 moving pictures, never used a double or stand-in for the dangerous stunts he performed. As a result, he had over 150 stitches taken in his hide, plus suffering 23 broken bones and cracked ribs. "I never claimed to be an actor," Tom said, "but some newspaper writer claimed I was the best showman on earth, even better than Buffalo Bill Cody, who never made a movie in his life. From the start, when I made my first starring picture for Fox, I made it a rule to never smoke a cigarette, take a drink, or gamble in any picture I ever made. A lot of youngsters made up a big part of the audience, and I aimed to set a good example for them. Instead of using a six-shooter and doing a lot of shooting, I used my fists or a catch rope and kept my pictures clean." His pictures had made more than $5 million. Tom Mix changed the subject to Hollywood script writers. "You'd never believe some of the scripts those white-collared screenwriters handed me. Some of the scenes were plumb ridiculous. The motion picture studio conferences were a big joke. All those dude writers ever did was to increase the overhead of the five real pictures." The following is taken from Tom Mix's Ropin' a Million. These story conferences are usually run off something like this way. Around a long mahogany table, a heap better than Napoleon ever ate often, in a room with more furniture than John D. Rockefeller and Henry Ford have got in their offices, gather the star, the chief scenarist, and three or four of his assistants. This head bird is likely to be drawing $1,000 a week, first assistant getting not less than $660, and the remaining three, $500, $360, and $200. The $500 and $360 a week birds probably were former song and dance men, and the $200 man, a young chap who wrote and achieved doubtful fame as an author of that popular melody, Missouri Blues, or A Lonesome Bird in a Cottonwood Tree. Personal, these here scenario writers ain't never been much help to me because I don't read music. But to get back to the story conference, any conference lasting less than 3 hours ain't no good. Not that anything is decided upon that gets in the picture, but it fills in the day until time to go out and shoot a few holes of golf, the latter being a byproduct of the moving picture business. At these here story conferences, all of them talk and talk and talk, but none of them says anything. They seem to get nowhere. Any suggestions that I may make, and me a know in the West, is properly squelched as being out of order. Anytime I talk, I am speaking out of my turn. About the second hour, I give up, fix myself comfortable in the big overstuffed leather chair, and snooze it out, leaving them to themselves and their own vacuum. So Tom Mix finally decided to write his own script, direct his own pictures, and furnish his own horse for $1,000 a week. Then came the day when the era of silent pictures was out like Nellie's eye. Replaced by talking pictures, Tom Mix, the king of Western movie stars, was over and done with. And for Tom Mix, the cowboy hero of clean, silent pictures, it was a heavy blow. Tom Mix had spent the $1 million he had made with the same reckless, carefree fragility of a $40 a month cowpuncher on a town drunk. In a sort of roundabout, lesser manner, the career of Tom Mix, star of the silent westerns, and my own career as a writer of pulp western yarns had something in common. Both of us had come up the hard way from a common cowhand, and at that time, I was making more money than I could spend. Tom Mix had pointed out, when he was getting a guided tour of the house, that it was a mighty fancy bunkhouse for a cowhand. It was Sheriff Ed Eccles who made the comparison, telling Tom that a month or two before, there had been in a local newspaper a picture of me and my horse Tex at the hitch rack in front of our house in the Catalina Foothills Estates, declaring me king of Western story writers. "There's times when this young feller goes hog wild," Sheriff Ed told Tom Mix. "When him and cowhands like Roy Adams and Buckshot Sawyers and some others take the notion to head for Nogales across the border, it's always up to me to ride herd on them. Walt and me has made a deal. When he's liquored up, he calls me up and I dispatch a sheriff's car and a deputy to take him in tow. In a lot of ways, you two are alike, Tom, wild and careless." All the time Sheriff Ed Eccles was talking in his habitual soft tone of voice, there was sort of a grin on his face and a twinkle in his eyes. "There was a time, Ed," Tom Mix reminded the sheriff, "when you sowed a goodly crop of wild oats yourself, when you were wild and reckless and didn't give a damn." Sheriff Ed chuckled softly. "Sure thing, Tom, but wearing a sheriff's badge sawed my horns off. I had to slow down. But a cowpuncher wearing a sheriff's badge takes care of his own kind regardless." That summed it up in a nutshell. And in my book and Tom Mix's book, Ed Eccles was the best sheriff Tucson ever had. And we so declared ourselves, and it called for another drink. After we were again comfortably settled in our chairs on the porch, Ed Eccles told us that in April 1907, he had hired out to Miller Brothers 101 Wild West show. Tom Mix was the show at the time. It was there that Ed met Will Rogers, and they got to be mighty good friends. It was years afterwards when Will Rogers was making pictures in Hollywood and Ed was running the first time for sheriff of Pima County that Will wired Ed that he'd take a day off and fly over to Arizona to do a little stump speeching in Ed's behalf, which he did. Will had his pilot set him down in what he thought was a likely town to gather votes for Ed, and he made the kind of speech that only Will Rogers knew how to make. Then he flew back to Hollywood, where he was in the middle of a picture. Ed wrote and thanked Will. "But the hell of it was, Will, Ed wound up his letter. They throwed out all them votes you corralled for me. You landed in Cochise County instead of Pima." We all got a chuckle out of Ed's story, and after fixing another drink, we were back on the porch talking this and that. Tom said that he had for a while vanished from the familiar stomping ground of Hollywood to put on his own Wild West show. For 3 years, Tom Mix's Wild Animal show had been a smash hit. He had played 220 stands throughout the country in 10 months, still doing his own writing. Now he was returning to Hollywood in the movies. Tom said that during those same years, he had been involved in expensive lawsuits. Zach Miller, of 101 fame, was suing him for a breach of contract. He was also involved in lawsuits over alimony. And as Tom talked, a note of bitterness crept into his rambling. Once a man was beset by troubles, some men he had once called friends were trying to stomp his guts out. But Tom Mix was never a man to call quits. The image Tom Mix had built up throughout the years as a cowboy hero was still intact. That memorable late afternoon of October 11th, 1940, was destined to have one of those rare Southwest sundowns that artists depict on canvas. The setting sun was a fire-colored crimson in a war-painted sky. The distant mountain ranges were a deep purple, the desert haze lingering with the last heat waves stretching into Old Mexico. There was a hushed silence except for the call of the quail as they came from the brush to feed on the grain I had scattered on the feeding ground. Mourning doves croned to feed, and cottontail and jackrabbits came to join the quail and doves. Kit foxes would soon appear at the feeding grounds, as well as chipmunks who chirped and chased one another. The birds would come for their evening meal. The kit foxes, timid by nature, seemed to sense that all animals and birds were protected on our land, and they would eat their fill of scraps thrown out, drink at the scattered Mexican clay dishes, then stretch out in the cool shade of the mesquites before they left for their dens in the foothills. The three of us sat for the most part in the hushed silence of the sunset, three cowpunchers who knew how to enjoy the quiet, each man lost in his own thoughts and dreams of yesterdays. I was the youngest in years, but we were all young at heart. Big, soft-spoken Ed Eccles, with a generous sprinkling of gray in his hair, the black-haired Tom Mix, who had retained his prideful youth. It was late dusk when my two visitors finally took their departure. The last drink, one for the road, had been drunk. Ed Eccles had promised to bring Tom out the next day for lunch. So, because we were to meet the following day, there were no handshakes or words of farewell. "So long, Walt. See you tomorrow," Tom Mix called back as they drove away. I stood there at the hitch rack and answered, "So long until tomorrow." I'm glad I didn't know at that moment that I would never see my good friend Tom Mix again. The following day, I quit work early and came up to the house to put the mesquite charcoal in the outside patio fireplace and set the grill in place. We were to have thick tenderloin steaks, and I had a case of Mexican Carta Blanca Cerveza that was rated better than American beer. I had invited the jovial Nick Hall, manager of the Santa Rita Hotel, an old-time friend of Tom's, to join us for lunch. 1 o'clock came and went, and no sign of Sheriff Ed or Tom Mix. Nary a sign of Nick Hall. 2 o'clock went by. It was along about 3 when the telephone rang. It was Nick, and I could tell by the tone of his voice that perhaps Tom Mix had suddenly decided to head for Florence to see his former son-in-law before going on to Hollywood. And I was right. Tom had done just that, leaving word with the day clerk on duty at the hotel to telephone me that he couldn't make it for lunch. But the clerk had forgotten to give me the message. I was disappointed, naturally, and I decided to head for Coleman's barn, saddle up, and ride into the hills. I was just going out the door when the telephone began ringing. It was Nick Hall again, informing me that news had just come in that Tom Mix had been killed in his car. It was later that I got the whole story. Tom Mix owned a flashy-looking Cord that he drove with the top down. The rear seat held his luggage, including a locker trunk. A highway crew was working on the Florence Highway, and they had put up a barrier with a detour sign. Tom Mix, traveling 80 miles an hour, had smashed through the barrier, turning the Cord over in a dry wash. The heavy trunk had been dislodged with a sudden impact, striking Tom on the back of the head and breaking his neck. He was killed instantly. Sheriff Ed Eccles had immediately gone to the scene of the wreck, midway between Oracle Junction and Florence. A coroner and an ambulance followed Ed. Nick Hall had been busy on the long-distance telephone to Hollywood to notify Mix's daughters and the studios. When we were finished talking and I'd hung up, I went into the game room. The folding bar had long since been set up. I poured a big shot of Bushmill's Irish whiskey and took my drink out on the porch where we had sat the day before. The shock of Tom's sudden death left me sort of numb and bewildered, and I wanted to be alone for a while. My wife had already left for town, so I was alone with my grief. The October afternoon was warm, and a few scattered clouds were in the sky, but the sun had lost something of its warmth as I took my drink outside to the long hitch rack. My thoughts were of yesterday, when Tom Mix was alive. So very much alive. There was a strange magnetism about Tom, hero of countless Western movies, which had endeared him to youths throughout the nation. Knowing him as I did in real life, I'd been proud to claim his friendship. Now there was an aching lump in my throat that no amount of good whiskey could dissolve. When I rolled and lit a cigarette, the good tobacco smoke had an acrid taste. I took another drag and stubbed out the half-smoked stub on the hitch rack. Then I got into the car and headed for Coleman's barn. I saddled Tex and rode off into the foothills. I remembered a bit of the conversation of the day before. I'd said that I always rode Tex of an afternoon, regardless of the weather, to get rid of the nervous tension left from my morning's work. And Tom Mix had said he felt the same way when he rolled Old Blue or Tony. Ride off alone, and an hour or so in the saddle, and our worries were gone. There is a strange sort of understanding between an old-time cowhand and his favorite horse. That understanding was there between me and Tex. It was as if that yellow tigered eye buckskin cowpony had an instinctive understanding of the grief that was in my heart. Maybe it had been in the tone of my voice as I talked while I was saddling him. Because that day, Tex wasn't looking for something to spook at. When a jackrabbit jumped from the brush a few feet ahead on the trail, he kept on traveling at his fast running walk, keeping steady along the winding trail through the mesquite and catclaw and chola cactus. I kept talking to Tex, low-toned, as I untangled a witch's knot in the long black mane, telling him how my old friend Tom Mix had died a tragic death that day. I figured Tom was crowding 60 and was past the prime of his life. His career as a star of Western movies was over and done with. Far worse things could have happened to Tom Mix than sudden death. Old age and being broke would have been his ultimate future. And the prideful man could not possibly have taken his stride old age as its infirmities and uselessness. Tom had roped his million and squandered the money like a cowpuncher in town. Tomorrow morning, his tragic death would be in big black headlines in every newspaper in the United States and other countries. It was a spectacular end to the greatest Western cowboy star that was ever known on the silver screen. If Tom Mix had deliberately planned the manner of his passing, it could never have been more fitting. Tom Mix had seen his last sunset in the welcome companionship of his old and true friend, Ed Eccles, a crimson sunset in a spectacular sky, with a panoramic view of the desert and mountain ranges and old Mexico. He had heard the sound of the quail and mourning doves blending into the bush twilight of that last sundown. All men are born to die, but it is given to few men that though they are long dead, they shall never die in the nostalgic memories of at least two generations of Americans who hero worshipped the image Tom Mix left behind when he crossed the Big Divide. He lived his own legend in real life and on the silver screen, and that legend is destined to live on forevermore. On the edge of Florence, Arizona, at Tom Mix Wash in the middle of the desert, there stands a rock monument with the statue of a riderless horse. It bears the following inscription: "In memory of Tom Mix, whose spirit left his body on this spot, and whose characterizations and portrayals in life served better to fix memories of the Old West in the minds of living man. True West Magazine, issue May-June 2024. Jerome, Arizona, by Peter Corbett. When you dig deep into Jerome's history, you find so many layers, so many stories of boom and bust, of bordellos, opium dens, gambling, and bootleg liquor, labor strife and striking miners deported from town on cattle cars. At the tail end of the 19th century, three fires leveled the hillside town in less than 2 years. That brought a do-gooder, Mrs. Thomas of the Salvation Army, who observed that the destructive fires were an object lesson, a visitation of God's wrath upon the sinful camp. The Weekly Journal Miner in May 1899 reported that Thomas stood in the street and prayed for the Sodom and Gomorrah of Arizona and said she was pained to see that the fire had not purified the place. Thomas predicted the Lord wasn't done with Jerome yet. God will burn it up a dozen times to make it a Christian town or nothing. Newspapers across the nation called Jerome the wickedest town in America, eclipsing hell-raising places like Dodge City, Deadwood, Tombstone, Leadville, and Cripple Creek. Jerome has come a long way since then, as it celebrates its 125th anniversary as a town this year. It has become a popular destination for desert dwellers and others for its arts and music scene, wine tasting, colorful history, and milder climate. We're a mile high in Jerome. We're cooler than Phoenix, and our temperatures are better too, joked Tom Pitts, a Jerome Chamber of Commerce board member. Plus, the views up here are spectacular. In 1899, Yavapai County voted to create a town government for the rowdy mining camp. That led to a Jerome building code requiring brick or masonry construction to thwart another town-leveling fire. As a result, countless buildings in Jerome today are at least a century old. Many date back to a rebuilding phase that started in 1899, Pitt said. It's quite remarkable what the town has become since mining ceased in 1953, 71 years ago. Jerome was left for dead. Miners fled, businesses shuttered, and movers trucked houses down the mountain to nearby Verde County communities. Jerome population dwindled from 12,682 in the 1920 census to 243 hardy souls in 1960. Today's population is just under 500 people living in a town designated as a National Historic District. The town's economy is sustained by close to 1 million visitors each year. Jerome State Historic Park, a good first stop for history buffs, is in the elegant 1916 mansion of Copper Baron James S. Douglas. Nearby is the Audrey Headframe Park, where visitors can look into a mine shaft 1,900 feet deep. The Jerome Historical Society Mine Museum on Main Street has a collection of mining and gaming artifacts and historic photos. A mile west of the main business block, the Gold King Mine Ghost Town features mining equipment, a stamp mill, miner shacks, vintage vehicles, a sawmill, and blacksmith shop. It's the real history, not the myths, Pitt said. We've got the real thing. History and the arts have long been Jerome's drawing cards. An influx of artists, many from the West Coast, discovered Jerome after the mines closed. They moved to town for cheap housing and studios, Pitts explained. Today, there are more than 30 art studios. The Jerome Artist Cooperative Gallery shows their work in the refurbished Hotel Jerome, which opened in 1917. The gallery is a focal point on the first Saturday of each month for the Jerome Art and Wine Walk. Jerome has 7 wine tasting rooms, part of the growing Verde Valley wine enterprise. Wine and spirits are also available on Main Street at the Klinkscale Hotel, the Spirit Room, and Paul and Jerry's Saloon, one of Arizona's oldest watering holes. The Spirit Room is the hub of Jerome's music scene. The corner bar in the Connor Hotel hosts rock and blues bands regularly on weekend afternoons and Friday evenings. The Jerome Music and Arts Festival is June 8th and 9th. Other events are planned for Jerome's 125th anniversary celebration. Some of the town's unique shops include the Miner's Pick and Rock Shop, Ricardora's Candy, and Nellie Bly, which boasts of having the world's largest gallery of kaleidoscopes. A longtime Arizona journalist, Peter Corbett lived in the Verde Valley below Jerome and has spent a lot of time in the town over the past half century. True West Magazine, May-June 2024 edition. Rebel Yankees, the McCulloch Colts, by Phil Spangenberger. When we think of Confederate revolvers, we generally envision six guns like Leach and Rigdon, Spiller and Burr, or the revolvers of the Dance Brothers. Of course, almost any handgun of the period of the war between the states certainly could qualify, since so many rebel soldiers used whatever guns were available to them. With the exception of battle prizes, Colt's revolvers would not normally be considered as Confederate. Colt was, however, among several Northern arms companies to sell to the Southern states, including their first 100 1860 models to their agent in Columbus, Georgia, on November 30, 1860, and at least one documented shipment of 1860s to the Confederate States War Department on April 15, 1861, a mere week after Fort Sumter was fired upon. Known among collectors as the McCulloch 1860 Army Colts, these Hartford-produced 44-caliber percussion six-shooters definitely have a Confederate-linked history. When the 1860 Army, then dubbed the New Army Model, was introduced in mid-1860, the first 4,000 guns were turned out with fully fluted, non-rebated, cylinders, sans roll engraved cylinder scenes. This was done to reduce weight, and they were referred to by Colt as cavalry models. Other than their fluted cylinders, these 60 models were just like the standard fully round, rebated cylinder guns with the roll engraved naval battle scene, an 8-inch round bevel with the rack, and pinion creeping loading level, and the military-style four-screw frame with the cutout on the heel of the grip for attaching a shoulder stock. Serial numbers of the McCulloch Colts ranged from 200 to 4,700, with most above 2,000. They would have had a plain walnut stock, been finished with a blued barrel, cylinder and trigger, a color case hardened frame, lever and hammer, and a brass trigger guard and backstrap. When the state of Texas passed their ordinance of secession on the 1st of February 1861, it joined the Confederate States of America on March 2, 1861. With the withdrawal of federal troops from the state, Texas's immediate concern was from Indian raids and Mexican incursions, more so than from Union troops. Former Texas Ranger Ben McCulloch wrote to Colonel Sam Holt on February 24, 1861, asking that since federal forces were being pulled out of Texas, at least 1,000 or two of your army-sized pistols would be needed by the Texas Rangers to guard against Indian attacks along her vast frontier, adding that he felt that Colt's pistol was among the best arms for such mounted service. McCulloch had enjoyed a long and friendly friendship with Samuel Colt and had recently acted as a sales agent for Colt's company. He also had been a staunch advocate of Colt's revolvers from his days as a Texas Ranger and throughout his other adventures in the West. In a letter to Colt, McCulloch asked that, as a favor on the Rangers of my state, the company shipped the arms immediately to Texas via New York to New Orleans, where he'd have them forwarded to Austin. He proposed that the revolvers would be paid for by the state of Texas. Colt could not refuse his old friend, nor miss a hefty sale, and the first shipment of 250 Colts was shipped in 5 cases to Ben McCulloch, care of Colt's agent Kittredge and Folsom of New Orleans, via New York, where they were loaded on the steamer Bienville, which sailed on the 1st of April, arriving in New Orleans on April 9th. A second shipment of 750 revolvers left on April 9th, traveling by land and reaching New Orleans on April 16th. From there, the entire 1,000 Colts were transported again by land via Adams Express, and once safely in Texas, were forwarded to Austin for disbursement. Shortly thereafter, on April 19th, President Lincoln issued a proclamation of blockade against southern ports, making shipment to and from the South extremely perilous, since the entire 3,500 miles of the Confederacy's Atlantic and Gulf coastline was under constant patrol from Union naval squadrons. Thus, only 1,000 of these McCulloch-ordered Colts were ever shipped. As of the most recent research, it's unclear which Texas units received these Colts, but it is thought that possibly McCulloch's brother Henry's 1st Regiment Texas Cavalry, also known as the 1st Regiment Mounted Rifles, and possibly Colonel John S. Rip Ford's 2nd Texas Mounted Rifles, may have wound up with a number of them. Coincidentally, by May 1861, as these units were being formed, Confederate President Jefferson Davis appointed Ben McCulloch a brigadier general in command of a district in the Confederacy's Trans-Mississippi area, taking him away from the region. By this time, with Texas desperately needing these weapons, they may well have already been issued to the Rangers serving along the Lone Star State's unguarded frontier. Although McCulloch had intended for these 60 Colts to be paid for by the state of Texas, that legislature had not had enough time to allocate funds for the sale, so the guns were charged to Ben McCulloch's personal account. With McCulloch's death less than a year later at the Battle of Pea Ridge in Arkansas, the debt was never resolved, leaving the Colt firm with a loss of $25,900. Regardless of whether they were used by the Rangers guarding the Texas frontier against Indian depredations or by the Texas Confederate cavalry in their defense of the Confederacy, they undoubtedly saw plenty of action. There are only about 49 McCulloch 1860 Colts known to still exist, and most of them show hard usage. Sold after Texas seceded from the Union, these coveted Yankee-manufactured Colts went on to earn lasting fame and battle honors as Rebel Six Guns. For further reading, the excellent volume, The Colt Model 1860 Army Revolver by Charles W. Pate is recommended and is available from the email orders@mantarmbooks.com, mantarmsbooks.com. True West Magazine, May-June 2024 edition. Rolling the Dice by Steve Friesen. Brian LaBelle's Old West auctions have become known for showcasing, all at one event, the full range of objects available for collectors of the West: saddles, art, firearms, Indian artifacts, spurs, photos, furniture, documents, and even clothing. A wide array of Western artifacts, including clothing from Western movie stars and other celebrities, was once again featured at the Old West Auction, now combined with Morphy Auctions in Las Vegas, Nevada on January 26th. LaBelle opened the auction catalog by stating that the auction had one of the most impressive selections of merchandise we've offered in 36 years, and the auction bore that out. The biggest seller at the Las Vegas auction was Edward Boland's personal silver-mounted gun belt, holding a pair of Colt single-action Army revolvers with silver grips. Praised by Boland scholar James Nottage as the most artistic and richly embellished Western-styled gun belt and holster set ever made, it sold for $307,500. The second highest selling auction item at the auction was a pair of silver and gold decorated parade chaps worn by Roy Rogers for publicity photos. The chaps sold for $184,500. Other celebrity used items sold included Rex Allen's nudie design jacket and pants set, which took $5,166, and a Lone Ranger outfit worn by Clayton Moore, which collected $18,450. Among the horse gear sold at the auction was a stunning Mexican saddle with peteado stitching of cactus fiber, plus accessories of sword, scabbard, and chaps, all of which hammered down at $15,990. The price for the saddle was exceeded by a flashy bridle made at the Yuma Territorial Prison that went for $22,140. A 60-foot-long rawhide riata made and signed by Luis B. Ortega brought $5,166. Spurs are always popular at the Old West auctions. The highest-selling spur set at this auction was a pair made by G.S. Garcia, which sold for $41,820. Several posters were sold at the auction, with a rare Colt advertisement featuring a cowgirl receiving $20,910, while a large Buffalo Bills Wild West poster in French brought $15,375. A poster-sized photograph of three champions of the Buffalo, Buffalo Bill, Pawnee Bill, and Buffalo Jones, sold for $8,610. This was the first appearance of LaBelle's Old West auction in Las Vegas. Despite the temptations of the flashing slot machines in the casinos and expensive rock shows at the Sphere, collectors of the West spent a total of $2.3 million on the auction selections. And now here is the Ask the Marshal column, written by Marshall Trimble. Wyatt Earp, Wagons, and Wild Woman. What is your opinion of Stuart Lake's Wyatt Earp biography, Frontier Marshal? Josh Taylor, Austin, Texas. Much of Lake's book comes from the fertile mind of Lake, but to his credit, it made a Western legend out of Wyatt. Lake had a tough job. He had to deal with Sadie Earp, who was a constant thorn in his side. She was hell-bent on making Wyatt a legend and forbid Lake to write anything about his or her jaded past. Interviewing Wyatt was also difficult. The man just didn't want to talk. Westerns often show a horseless cowboy carrying his saddle. Were they that valuable? Tom Gronsky, St. Louis, Missouri. A cowboy's saddle might cost him about $40. He probably earned about $30 a month, so it was a big investment. Besides, a cowboy might have an attachment to a well-broken-in saddle. Did Westward Wagons only have one team pulling them all the way, or were there extra animals that were swapped out? Joel Conway, Doraville, Georgia. A wagon had to be light enough to not overtax the mules or oxen that pulled it, and strong enough not to break down under loads of as much as 2,500 pounds. Most didn't have extra animals, so the travelers had to take care of what they had. Where did the term shoots from the hip come from? Lance Crawford, Richmond, Virginia. Shoots from the hip refers to a person who is a straight shooter, an honest and very direct person. It also refers to speaking without thinking, without taking aim, if you will. An interesting combination. Fast, honest, but not necessarily accurate. Have you ever heard of a colorful, wild woman of the West named Prairie Rose? Susan Clark, Greeley, Colorado. Some historians say the tale of Prairie Rose is a myth, but here's the story. Prairie Rose, real name unknown, was a beautiful young harlot in the rowdy town of Ellsworth, Kansas. One day, she bet a cowboy $50 that she would ride a horse down Main Street bare naked the following day at high noon. Next day at 12 o'clock, there she rode. In Rose's right hand was her Colt revolver, and she pointed it in the direction of any man who dared look her way. Prairie Rose collected her winnings and rode into pages of Western folklore. If it's not true, well, it should be. Has there been any DNA test of Billy the Kid or his mother to determine if he really died in Fort Sumner? Hector Garza, Laredo, Texas. The simple answer is no. A few years ago, two New Mexico sheriffs and the mayor of Capitan, New Mexico, proposed a 21st century solution. Exhume the remains from the gravesites of Billy and his mother, Catherine Antrim, who is buried in Silver City, New Mexico, and match the DNA against a sample taken. The results would confirm or disprove all the claims to the real Billy the Kid. However, the mayors of Silver City and Fort Sumner both denied permission to exhume the graves. The problem is that nobody is certain that Catherine and Billy are actually buried where their monuments say they are. Flooding of the Pecos River at Fort Sumner in 1889 and 1904 disturbed Billy's burial site and that of his two friends, Tom Folliard and Charlie Boder. They are buried in the area, but the actual site is uncertain. There are similar questions about Catherine Antrim's remains. There's another factor. The mayors of those two locales and area citizens don't want those graves to be touched. They are tourist attractions. And what if it's discovered that Billy isn't the real Billy?
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.